Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning. I'm Angela Davis, and you're listening to NPR News. Glad you could join us today. A recent Gallup poll found that only 44% of women say they are satisfied with the way women are treated by society. That's a record low number. And Minnesota is no exception when it comes to gender disparities. Women in Minnesota face a persistent wage gap. They are disproportionately represented in lower-paying service jobs, and they struggle to access childcare and support for caregiving. This hour, I'm talking about the challenges women face in our state and what changes we can make to address them. And I want to hear from you, our listeners. Women, are you dissatisfied? What challenges have you experienced in the workplace and at home? And how is domestic responsibility divided in your household? What changes do you want to see to how women are treated in Minnesota? The phone lines are open. You can call us at 651-227-6000 or 800-242-2828. You can also tweet me at Angela Davis, NPR. Let's meet our guests. We have with us Christina Ewig. Christina is the faculty director of the Center on Women, Gender, and Public Policy at the University of Minnesota, and she's also a public affairs professor. Good morning to you, Christina.
Good morning, Angela. Happy to be here.
And also on the line, we have Lulit Mola. Lulit is the Chief Strategy and Innovation Officer of the Women's Foundation of Minnesota. Hi, Lulit.
Good morning, Angela. Thank you for having us.
All right, let's talk about this. Christina, what's your reaction when you hear the statistic from Gallup that a record low number of women say they're satisfied about how they're treated by society? What do you think when you hear that?
Well, it's not surprising to me, and I actually think in those Gallup poll numbers, there was another question in terms of belief and gender equality and job opportunities in the U.S. And there, it's only 33% of women that believe that there's gender equality and job opportunities in the U.S. It's not surprising given the status of women in the workforce over the long term and how that hasn't changed to a great degree in terms of changing of the wage gap, in terms of changing of care responsibilities in the home and the ability to manage both care of children or of elders or housework along with work. And all of that's been exacerbated by the pandemic. So to me, when I looked at these numbers, I think that the pandemic is probably helping to drive down that satisfaction because so many of these inequalities have been laid bare by the pandemic.
And Lulit, what do you think about this poll showing so much dissatisfaction among women?
Like Dr. Ewig, I am also not surprised. You know, I think not satisfied is such a minimized way of saying women and their families are in a crisis that we haven't seen since the Great Depression. And for women of color in particular, since always existing in this country. And for those of us who live, breathe, and vision women's equality and equity and justice and freedom every day, this is the reality of women, girls, gender expansive people and families in our state. So I'm like, yes, good. I'm glad we're talking about it. Now let's talk about the solutions we need so that we can truly thrive in the state.
So, Lulit, obviously, this category of women, it's very broad. The experiences of women vary, really, on you know, where we live, how old we are, race, economic status, you know, whether they're LGBTQ, whether they are caregivers. But the Women's Foundation, you all have done a series of listening sessions over the past year, focusing on many different groups of women. And tell me, you know, the value of doing that and the types of things that you're learning from those listening sessions.
Yes, of course. So last year, we did 9 listening sessions with about 80 women and 13 nonprofit organizations across the state. And we do this for a couple of reasons. One, we believe listening is an action, as in the people most impacted by the societal issues that we are working to resolve should be the folks giving us the solutions to what we need to do to create a Minnesota, again, where women, girls, and families thrive. And we do, every 2 years, we do our Status of Women research, the state's leading research on women, girls, and families with the Center for Women, Gender, and Public Policy. Dr. Ewig led that. And then we take those statistics and good data on the road. So we say, here's what we learned about childcare. Here's what we learned about women in the workplace. How does this show up in your life? And what that gives us is lived experience, stories, and narratives of how women are truly doing. And then we're able to nuance the numbers. We're able to truly understand how, you know, 48% of women saying that they're satisfied and the rest saying they're unsatisfied, how that translates to their everyday lives. And it is so critical because it shapes our strategies, it shapes our investments. And we ask every system, whether that's philanthropy or government or education, to do the same. Follow the voices of people most impacted when you're crafting your solutions for change.
And before we get into the details of some of what came out in the listening sessions, I'm curious, Christina, do you agree with Lulit's description? She said that women and children are in crisis, not just dissatisfied, but in crisis.
I would say that that is the case, especially for our lowest income families, which also tend to be more families of color, where there simply isn't. I'm glad that we're starting to use this word nationally to refer to care supports. There simply isn't the infrastructure in terms of childcare, sick leave, paid leave, to be able for these families to manage work and family considerations at the same time. If you're higher income, it probably doesn't feel like you're in crisis because you're able to pay for those supports and it doesn't hurt the pocketbook as much. So I think it's a variegated experience.
So, Lee, tell us, what did you hear in these listening sessions? What did you learn about women who are experiencing economic instability, for example?
Sure. You know, earlier you said women is such a broad category because while we are women, we are also gender expansive people. We're also Black women and Native women and Asian women and Latina women, women with disabilities, older women, girls, and women in rural Minnesota and women in the city. So when we did our listening, we ensured that we had representation of all of the people that make women, girls, and gender expansive people. And specifically around economics, we zoomed in on how women that identify as immigrants or undocumented are facing the workplace. And we learned a couple of things. One, we learned how imperative the infrastructure of care is for the well-being of women at the workplace. So a lot of women shared with us their struggles of finding care for their children, care for their aging parents, and still being able to show up at the workplace where they barely have any paid time or sick time or paid leave. We also learned the intersections of women working and women not being safe. So we heard stories of women being harassed at the workplace, reporting their harassment just to be blamed for what they were wearing or how they were showing up. And then depending on their immigration status, they were or were not able to report what they were experiencing. And last, we learned that women are still facing incredible wage gap. And for women of color in particular, it's worse. You know, and Dr. Ewig can talk to this, Native and Latina women and Somali women make about 48 cents to 54 cents to every dollar a white man makes in the state. And so when the pandemic hit and women were forced out of the workplace because, you know, one in three women of color, for example, work in the service industry, they didn't have a lot of a financial cushion to depend on, or they weren't getting a lot of financial support from our local government or their workplace. And so economics was definitely a theme across all of our listening sessions. And the last thing I'll add to this was we heard shared struggles from older women to girls. You know, girls told us about being caretakers for their families at the age of 15, 16, mm-hmm. particularly for Native girls and immigrant girls and Black girls. And then when we talked with older women, they talked about how they're still paying off college loans in their elder years, or how they can barely afford rent or their healthcare expenses, which really showed us that financial insecurity is compounded over time. And so while we did hear from this diverse set of women, girls, and gender expansive people, there were shared struggles that we could easily tackle if we were focused on gender equity.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about women and gender disparities. And I want to hear from you, our listeners. Want to know, women, are you dissatisfied? And what are some of the challenges that you are experiencing right now in the workplace, at home, within your families? How is, you know, how are the responsibilities within your household divided? And what changes do you want to see to how women are treated and the support services that are available for women? What do you want to see change? You can call us at 651-227-6000. Also call us at 800-242-2828. And want to let our listeners know, too, tomorrow we're going to be talking more in depth about childcare and access to childcare and the challenges there. But as we talk with our two guests, I want to learn more about the wages and pay, the disparities there in wages. And Christina, what can you tell us more about what we're seeing there still in 2021?
2021, the gender wage gap really has not budged very much. Women on a whole in Minnesota earn 79 cents for every dollar that white men earn. And as Lulit mentioned, this varies significantly depending upon your race or ethnicity. So Latino women earn 55 cents. This is the latest data that we've run for the upcoming next status report. The Latina women earn 55 cents for every dollar that a white male earns in Minnesota. And if we break down the category of Black, so Black women as a whole make 61 cents for every dollar that white men make. Whereas if we break it down between Somali women and other Black women, Somali women make the least, 48 cents for every dollar that white men make. And if we break down Asian, category of Asian women, there's huge distinctions between different Asian groups, with Hmong women making the least at 60 cents for every dollar. So that's a lot of numbers there. But the point is that we still don't have gender parity when it comes to wages. And women of color in particular are bringing home less money. And as Lulit said, many are in the service sector, and that is the sector in which we are least likely to see things like paid sick leave, specific benefits, whereas you see more of those kinds of standard benefits in the manufacturing sector, but not in the service sector. And
And Lulu, you mentioned workplace harassment. Can you think of some of the examples of what women shared and like what's happening at work?
Sure. You know, a couple of years ago, we experienced the Me Too movement, and it was everywhere we turned. And I remember activist Tarana Burke, the founder of the movement, said, mm-hmm. if women of upper class status and women in Hollywood are sharing these stories, imagine what low wage working women are experiencing. Mm. Right. So we heard about, and I mentioned immigrant women in particular, experiencing harassment and discrimination at the workplace. And it connected, you know, with their sexuality or their sex. We heard about, again, they were reporting what they were experiencing and were faced with blame for being the perpetuators of that violence instead of solutions. We also heard from girls working at the workplace, and this isn't necessarily categorized as harassment, but young people being breadwinners or being a large part of their family income, but not being respected as such. So early on, when a lot of people lost their jobs to the pandemic, you know, youth were not given unemployment until they fought for it. And so harassment can look like gender-based violence against women and girls. That includes, you know, sexual assault, harassment, rape, but it can also look like financial insecurity and just being left out of the conversation when it comes to having choice and power over their own agency.
And Lily, what about immigrant women? Can you tell me more about what they shared in listening sessions and what some of their challenges are?
Yes. So in addition to the safety concerns I raised, again, we heard a lot about the lack of childcare options for immigrant women, having to choose between taking care of their children and working. And then when they have to work, because a significant majority of women, Black women, Latina women are also the heads of their households in single mother homes, and having to leave their children with the neighbor or with community. But, you know, we also heard stories of resilience and hope. We heard stories of how communities of women would come together to take care of each other in this time of crisis. And we heard a call to recognize them also as dependable childcare infrastructures, right? So often we think about parent-aware starred ratings for childcare, but also it's your neighbor, it's your grandmother, it's your auntie that's taking care of the children. So how can we support them as they're taking up these roles of caretaking for our children in the community?
I mentioned tomorrow we're talking about childcare, the affordability and just the availability of childcare. Why does that seem to affect women more than men? Christina?
Well, I think it reflects on the wage gap. And so all of these elements are tied together. Families make logical decisions. So if you have a family with two parents that are working and childcare, which high-quality infant childcare in the state of Minnesota costs as much as tuition at the University of Minnesota. So, and I can share my experience, not in Minnesota, but when I had my first child, my entire wage went to childcare. And so if you're in a family in which two adults are working and one makes less than the other, it may make a lot of sense for that person to work part-time or stay home with the kids. And that tends to be because of our culture, it tends to be women that do that more often. So there's a real economic reason for doing that, but then there are long-term consequences of that, because we see that when women take time out of the workforce, that can have dramatic impacts on their lifelong earnings. Mm-hmm. There was one national study that showed that if women took just 1 year off of work over a 15-year period, their lifetime earnings dropped by 39% compared to women that did not take that time off. Mm. So there's real economic trade-offs, and that's why we see this happening.
Yeah, and I want to repeat that statistic because it was very stunning for me to read that. I mean, I'm aware that Minnesota has extremely high child care costs, but yes, one of the statistics in your last report really highlighted this, that the average cost of center-based infant care, which is the most expensive in Minnesota, is more than the annual cost of college tuition at the University of Minnesota. It's just, you know, I just have to sit with that for a minute. Let's take a phone call as we talk about women and gender disparities here in Minnesota and what's going on in the workplace and at home and why so many women are feeling dissatisfied. The number to call is 651-227-6000. Again, 651-227-6000 in Minneapolis. Courtney's on the phone. Courtney, what do you want to share with us as we talk about women?
Yeah, thanks for taking my call, Angela. I'm calling because I am a healthcare worker in the Twin Cities, and I left my full-time, decent-paying job in January of this year. I had a baby in July of last year, and I also have a 5-year-old at home. Mm-hmm. And the week that I returned to work, I got COVID. Mm-hmm. So my entire family was quarantined. Of course, I was out on unpaid time because I had expended all of my PTO on my maternity leave and ended up being home for several weeks unpaid in addition to having no benefits. So quit my job and decided to try the stay-at-home parent thing while my partner worked, who also works in healthcare and actually was making less than I was at the time, but because of threats of being laid off at my position, it made sense for me to take the higher cut. So I have been off of work now until recently. I just started at a much lower paying position, but still am struggling with childcare issues, especially in the midst of having an infant and a preschool aged kid during the pandemic.
What is your childcare issue, Courtney?
Mostly it's scheduling and the cost. You know, mm-hmm. I have a child who's in the public school system, so his hours are 9 to 3:30, but that's not a reasonable time for me to do a full day of work. So we still mm-hmm. have to adjust our schedules for morning and after school care because there's not an option available due to the limited time, and I can't leave a 5-year-old at home alone or expect mm-hmm. him to get to school by himself.
It's stressful.
Very.
Mm-hmm. That's Courtney in Minneapolis. Thank you for sharing that, Courtney. And Luli, when you hear that, what do you think?
Yeah, you know, one of the listening sessions we did were COVID-19's impact on women on the front lines. And so in addition to talking to about gender disparities, I also want to recognize that women hold up our communities at home, at the workplace. When the pandemic hit, it was women as teachers, as healthcare workers, that really showed up and continue to show up to get us through. And so what we heard a lot from women who are also healthcare workers is that there is also a mental health crisis, balancing the stress of a home, as Courtney just shared, having a child, showing up at work and taking care of others, the pandemic, and really not having room to process or take care of your mental health could mm-hmm. have detrimental impacts on the well-being of not only the woman, but also her whole family. And so when we're having these conversations, even though we are leading with women and girls, you know, I think about whole families. We're mm-hmm. talking about the state of our community, because if women are not well, none of us are well.
Mm. I want to make sure I ask you, Lulit, about what your listening sessions there, the Women's Foundation of Minnesota that you've been doing. What did you find out about women in rural communities? Are there stories very similar, or are there some things that stand out about women in rural parts of Minnesota?
Yeah, you know, while we have this conversation about the urban-rural divide, the truth is women have shared experiences across the state. And so if we invested in shared narratives and working together, we could really get far. They shared struggles of childcare. They shared struggles of elder care. They shared struggles of gender discrimination at the workplace or feeling and being unsafe at home and in their communities. And they have specific struggles based on their geography. So what we heard was women wanted to take control of the narrative of rural women. Often rural women are talked about and not talked with. Mm-hmm. And so they shared this desire to tell their own stories. We also heard in smaller communities, women are, you know, penalized for speaking up for progressive issues because, you know, when they go outside, they'll see their neighbor in a different way than some of us would in the city. Mm-hmm. And lastly, women, girls specifically in rural Minnesota, were a lot more open to progressive ideas and building with other girls that may not necessarily look like them more than their elders. And so there were many promising stories of shared opportunity between our rural Minnesota sessions and our urban sessions.
And Christina, what stands out to you about the experiences of women in rural parts of the state?
Well, I think there are a couple ways in which there are some differences. And one has to do, a big piece has to do with accessibility to prenatal and maternal care in mm-hmm. our rural hospitals, yes. where we've really seen a precipitous drop in those services In addition, when we look across the state, accessibility of reproductive health care and reproductive health care clinics, and especially access to abortion, is much more scarce in our rural areas. We also see that slightly more women in rural areas are in minimum wage jobs. It's not a huge difference between the urban area, mm-hmm. but that's where investment in healthcare, but also investment in, for example, minimum wage laws that could raise the minimum wage would be really make a big difference for rural women. Beyond that, I do agree with Lulit. They share similar issues. Child care, there's slightly different proportions. There's a bit more home-based child care that's available in rural areas and fewer center-based. But if you wanted center-based child care, then that's not as available in rural areas. So we've got some distinctions, but together, both rural and urban areas lack the child care that's necessary for the demand. And they face similar kinds of economic issues as well.
All right. Well, I want to hear from our listeners, reminding you that we're taking your phone calls. The phone lines are open. You can call us at 651-227-6000 or 800-242-2828 as we talk about gender disparities and what we're seeing now, still in 2021, a record low number of women across the country say that they feel satisfied with the way that they are treated by society. And we're talking about the challenges that women face at home and at work. Give us a call at 651-227-6000 or 800-242-2828. We're going to continue talking with our guests after the news break, but let's check in with John Wanamaker to see what's going on in the news. Hi, John. Yes, 1A is on next with Jen White at 10 a.m. here on NPR News. Then at noon, be sure to listen to Minnesota Now, hosted by Kathy Werzer. Tomorrow morning at 9, we're checking in on childcare. I'm going to really dive into what's happening with childcare. It is often called the workforce behind the workforce, and it was hit hard by the pandemic. How are childcare workers and providers doing now? And we'll also be talking about some possible solutions to the childcare shortage and the high costs, as we're hearing about today. That's tomorrow morning at 9. Right now on the podcast, you can listen to a conversation that guest host Chris Farrell just had about local beer, wine, and spirits. Minnesota has more than 35 craft distilleries, 106 craft breweries, and 7 wineries. And Chris talked with local drink writers and distillers about what to drink as we gear up for the holidays. Check that out on the podcast. Search for NPR News with Angela Davis wherever you get your podcasts.
Programming is supported by the law firm of Dorsey & Whitney, committed to being an inclusive organization that values diverse backgrounds, perspectives, and contributions. Learn more online at dorsey.com/diversity.
Now back to the conversation about gender disparities in Minnesota. A recent Gallup poll found that a record number of women say they are not satisfied with how women are treated by society. And I'm exploring the challenges that women in Minnesota face and what we can do about it. My guests today include Christina Ewig, the faculty director of the Center on Women, Gender, and Public Policy at the University of Minnesota, and a public affairs professor there, and Lulit Mola, the chief strategy and innovation officer of the Women's Foundation of Minnesota. And we're taking your phone calls, asking about the challenges that you have experienced in the workplace and at home if you're woman, and how domestic responsibility is divided up in your household, and what changes you want to see to how women are treated in Minnesota. Call us at 651-227-6000 or 800-242-2828. Let's take a phone call right now in Minneapolis. Alan's been holding on. And Alan, what do you want to share with us about what you have witnessed?
Well, I have a statement and a question. One, I want to know if the study did tracked how much lost productivity that we as Americans have because of the limitations on our single moms and women of color. The other is, I am a carpenter and I've worked in property management, and I see the biases. Sometimes men get angry and will put obstacles intentionally because they feel that women don't have the right to be in that workplace. You know, as a carpenter, I've seen it many a times. I've seen the discrimination in the rental process. One instance, I've seen a property manager discriminate against a woman because she was there with her children. Mm-hmm. He didn't know that her husband had died as a service member. So much the biases, especially women of color. So you got the biases against women, then you have the biases against women of color. So it's like a crapshoot, you know, when they go to apply for a job or if they're in the workplace. And that's what I want to add.
Thank you, Alan in Minneapolis. Christina, what do you make of what Alan is saying? He's witnessed it, you know, a woman showing up with her children and discrimination or bias that women sometimes face because of, you know, assumptions people are making about them.
Absolutely. Alan is absolutely right about those biases. And I'll just first answer his question about the lost productivity mm-hmm. piece. The Minneapolis Fed put together some statistics related to what we lose as a state by not having parity in wages and women's full participation in the workforce. And they estimate that it equals $126 billion in lost domestic product for the state. So if we made up for these gender inequities, our state would be doing much better financially. But the biases are absolutely right. And so this comes back to these questions of sexual harassment on the job that Lulit spoke about already and coming from the listening sessions. We do see greater amounts of sexual harassment as women try to enter into occupations that are dominated by men. And those are occupations that pay better. So we want to encourage women to go into those occupations, but it's often difficult for them to stay in them because of the harassment that they face. We see this in all kinds of jobs, but we especially see it as women enter construction, for example, or in higher levels of management. There's also studies, there's a good study by my colleague at the University of Minnesota, Chris Eugen, and some of his co-authors that followed Minnesota girls since eighth grade into their early years in the workforce. And it showed that due to harassment, they would leave good paying jobs and take a step down to other jobs because they didn't want to have to deal with the negative environment that mm-hmm. they were placed in. So it's not just anecdotal what Alan brings up. We've seen it systematically studied, and it's something that pushes women out of the workforce into other kinds of jobs or into lower paying jobs.
And Lulit, wanted to ask you what you think about what that caller Alan described, the bias and discrimination that he's witnessed as he has worked, and also his concerns about lost productivity.
Yeah, you know, a theme or a frame to approach this conversation is intersectionality, and it's gaining more popularity. But simply put, it's recognizing that we as women live in our bodies within multiple identities. So yes, we are women, but for me, for example, I am also a Black woman. I'm also a Black immigrant woman. And all three of those identities shape my experiences in my day-to-day life. And so in addition to women experiencing bias and discrimination at the workplace. You know, there are particular biases like racism that Black women and Native women and additional women of color experience at the workplace. And when we were talking with women in these listening sessions, we heard the difference sometimes regarding these issues is more than productivity, although that is important. Often it is a matter of life and death. Women are experiencing their everyday lives, wondering if they're going to come home safe, if they're going to come home alive, if their children will be alive. And so there is this spectrum of discrimination. On one end, it is workplace obstacles, as Alan referred to it. And on the other, it can look like missing and murdered Indigenous women. And so just recognizing the full entirety of what it means to live in a woman's body or a gender expansive person's body.
Mm. I want to take a moment to also let our listeners know we're going to be talking next Tuesday, in fact, on this show about domestic violence and the increases that we've seen in Minnesota. And then also next Wednesday, we'll be talking about men's mental health. I want to take a moment to bring in my colleague, Chris Farrell, here. He joins me on Mondays to get us caught up on the big developments in the recovery of the economy and other money matters. And Chris is joining us now. Chris, what can you tell us about the gender disparities that economists are tracking?
So, you know, I think you would sum it up as a lost opportunity. I mean, if you go back to the 1990s and you look at the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development and, you know, the major industrial nations, three dozen, you know, the U.S. in terms of women's labor force participation rate was toward the top. And now we're way down. Way down. And we have just missed as opportunities. And what changed is that so many other nations put in family-friendly policies, and those family-friendly policies were enabling people to raise their families and work more easily. I mean, this conversation keeps going back to child care, doesn't it, Angela? And elder care would be something that's very important. And just one other study for people to look at, Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco did this study. And back in the early 1990s, the labor force participation rate of women in Canada and the U.S. was pretty much the same. And since then, the gap has just grown. Labor force participation rate in Canada has gone way up. And right now, and ours was stagnant for most of that period of time, just slightly down. And the only reason the economists could come up with, again, is child care, elder care, family leave. I mean, these caregiving policies really do make a difference.
So we're seeing that in other nations that they're addressing it, and it makes a difference. All right. Well, we also know I saw a lot of these headlines on Friday. The employment report came out, and overall, they're saying that the month of October was a good month.
It was a good month. So we added 531,000 jobs. The unemployment rate dropped down to 4.6%. To the topic that we're talking about today, according to the National Women's Law Center, nearly 57% of the jobs in October went to women. And that's largely reflecting mostly in the gains in retail trade, leisure, hospitality, the education sectors. But women are still lagging behind during this recovery, the employment side of this recovery. And just toss in one other number, because I think it's very important for us to keep track of. Black workers overall in October, the unemployment rate held steady at 7.9%. And that's the highest of any racial or ethnic category.
In labor. Okay. And that's information that's tracked by the Labor Department.
That's right.
All right. And in terms of the economy, are we seeing growth, or where are we doing? Are we
slowing
down?
We're still growing. I mean, we did slow down dramatically, but we're still growing. The employment rate really says that businesses are continuing to hire. And I think the way to look at it, Angela, is that the economy got sidetracked during the summer, and largely because of the Delta variant. And now that wave seems to be receding, and despite all the controversies, the vaccination rate continues to grow, the economy looks like it's getting back on track.
And one more thing I want to ask you about, what's happening in Congress. That Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, more than $1 trillion in transportation and other, you know, infrastructure spending over the next decade, it passed with bipartisan support. This is a big deal?
It's a big deal. And the U.S. has long neglected its infrastructure investment way too long. And so this is a big deal. This is the kind of investment that's pay off. I want to highlight very quickly just two things. One, the increase in spending in broadband, I think, is incredibly important for rural Minnesota.
Finally.
Yes.
Finally.
For all the rural parts of our country, that's incredibly important. And the other thing is, you know, this is construction, steel, cement, infrastructure. And infrastructure has a lack of qualified workers, young workers. The industries were worried about it even well before the infrastructure spending, this bill. So this is an incredible opportunity. This is an opportunity for these industries to embrace greater diversity in apprenticeship programs and worker training. And those are two time-tested ways to advance careers and lead to higher wages. So seize the opportunity for greater diversity in hiring.
Mm. Well, Chris is our senior economics contributor here at NPR News. And Chris, we're still talking about gender disparities that we continue to see, and and you know, why women are saying that they are dissatisfied with what's going on in the workplace and at home, and taking phone calls. So let's take a phone call now in Bloomington, where Dan is on the line. Dan, thanks for waiting. And what did you want to share with us?
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. One of the observations that I've had that I think contributes to gender disparities that hasn't been discussed is it has to do with the way that boys and girls are raised in this country. And it's certainly been my observation that boys continue to be raised to be earners and nothing else, whereas girls are raised to be earners possibly, but also caregivers. And that comes with certain advantages for men when they reach that point, for sure. One is that employers then have a tendency to value men more because they're not seen as having divided loyalties, whereas women are seen as having divided loyalties between work and family. But there's disadvantages to men, too, and I don't think that's really being recognized. One of those disadvantages is that when men try to step out of that gender role and try to be a caregiver or the primary parent, they're also met with stigma and rejection. So I think that there's two sides to the way in which gender role really limits men and women. And I think both need to be addressed if we're going to make progress in either one. Mm.
That's Dan in Bloomington talking about how did we get here and going back to childhood. Any thoughts on what he just expressed there, Lulit?
Yes, thank you, Dan. I think men and boys are part of the solution. You know, we're talking about whole communities and whole families, and gender norms is what he's referring to. Absolutely have a part to do with the ways we see men and women. We're also expanding our definition of gender, including people who identify beyond the binary. So this is a great time to interrogate what we believe about each gender and what is true and what is not true. I will also say when we deepen the frame to include women of color, we must include men and boys. You know, one of our participants in the listening session said, quote, George Floyd called for his mother, right? Mm-hmm. And so a lot of Black women shared with us their hopes and dreams and fears around raising Black sons. And so when we're thinking about equality for them and justice for them, we must include their husbands, their brothers, and their children. And so I can connect this to economics, we often talk about the gender wage gap, 78 cents to the dollar for women of color is 54 cents and so on. But what we don't talk about is the men and boys in those same households are earning 64 cents, 69 cents, right? And so we must start with the people most pushed to the margins, which are often the case, women of color, Black women, Native women, Latina women, and so forth, but also include the whole family if we're truly going to create a society that works for each of us.
And Christina, Dan, our caller, is questioning, like, what's going on in childhood? Like, what is leading us to these gender norms that we're seeing? Christina, what do you think about what he is saying?
Yeah, I think that when I was thinking about policy solutions on this, in terms of speaking to those on this show, policies can only go so far, and a lot has to do with how we do raise our boys and our girls and our expectations of them, beginning with things like, you know, we know that the psychological studies show that boys and girls do well in math up until about, both do equally well in math until up until about middle school, in which girls are sent a social message that math isn't for them. And that's when you begin to see the differences. And it doesn't have to do with ability. It has to do with their confidence in the area. And so that's where we begin to see a lot of differences taking place culturally. At the same time, policies can make a difference. And so I want to go to Dan's point that employers may value men more because they won't have divided loyalties. We know from studies in other countries that when you provide and you require paid leave for fathers, we begin to see a difference in how fathers act in the household. They begin to take up more childcare responsibilities, for example. And so we see a balancing in terms of gender roles in the household. But we also see some differences, and we have a recent post on the Gender Policy Report, which is a blog that the Center on Women, Gender, and Public Policy runs. But last week, we ran a summary of recent research that showed that those companies that provide more generous paid leave that's gender neutral for both men and women, which is what we have in the United States, there is actually less of a commitment penalty for fathers than it is for mothers. So in other words, companies that have generous leave tend to not penalize men in terms of their views of whether they are committed or not to work, and though they continue to penalize women. So that it's an interesting reverse where you would expect women to be penalized. But in conditions of high generosity, men tend not to be penalized, whereas women are. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Anyway, it's a bit of a counterintuitive finding. But I think what it sends the message is that generous paid leave policies can be good for changing the ways in which both caregiving is split within households, but also can actually be good for men in the workplace where they won't necessarily experience a negative reaction by employers if employers have generous policies in place.
Let's take one more phone call before our time is up. In Woodbury, we have Lolly on the line. And good morning, Lolly. What did you want to tell us or ask?
Good morning, Angela. First of all, I just want to say that I really enjoy your show. And
thank you.
Try to listen to it every day.
Oh, thank you.
But about today's show, and I apologize if I missed this information, but because I missed the first few minutes of the show. Mm-hmm. But when I started listening, you were comparing the wages of women of color to the wages of white male. And I was just wondering if you have the information about the wages of the women of the color compared to men of the color, men of the same race. Because when you introduce the race in the issue with comparing to males of white, white males, then you're introducing race. And that's another, whole issue that different races are making different amounts of money. Mm-hmm. So just wondering if you have that information.
Okay. So you're a woman of color. And so you're asking about, is it better to compare the wages of women of color to men of color? Let me ask our guest about that. And Lulie, did that come up in some of your research, the listening sessions, these comparisons?
Yeah, so I'll just say with Black women and Black men in the state, Black women are earning 61 cents compared to Black men who are earning 65 cents. And then with Latina and Latino men and women, Latinas are earning 54 cents and the men are earning 62 cents. So again, the men are not earning that much more than the women, which makes the conversation of racial justice imperative to pair with gender justice. And so at the Women's Foundation of Minnesota, we recognize that there is no gender equity without racial equity and vice versa. And we must have whole conversations that includes women of color and their families to find the right solutions.
And Christina, can you add anything to that, the research or stats on comparing the wages of women of color to men of color?
I mean, what Lulie said is absolutely correct. We see women earning less than men across all racial categories, but it's absolutely right that men of color are earning less than white men. And so to address these wage disparities, it really is about the intersection of gender and race and ethnicity, which has to do a lot with, we could get into like why we have these disparities. A portion of it is discrimination. Another portion of it is occupational segregation, where different groups are working in the workplace and how we value the work that they're providing. If we go back to the COVID-19 context, you can think about during the closures in which we had essential workers going into work, many of whom were low-paid workers but facing the highest risks. And that was very racialized and gendered as well, in terms of having higher proportions of women and higher proportions of people of color in those jobs where they had to continue going to work and have and had a high degree of interaction with other people and thus a high vulnerability to COVID-19.
Well, to our guests, I want to let you know we're out of time, but I thank you so much for all that you've shared and just enlightening us and what we're still seeing in 2021 when it comes to gender disparities. And I love what you said, Lulit, about interrogating what we believe. Our guests today have been Lulit Mola, the Chief Strategy and Innovation Officer of the Women's Foundation of Minnesota, and Christina Ewig, the Faculty Director of the Center on Women, Gender, and Public Policy at the University of Minnesota, as well as a Public Affairs Professor. And thanks to Chris Farrell, our Senior Economics Contributor, who joins us each Monday. And thank you to all of our listeners who shared your stories and questions. This conversation was produced by Samantha Matsumoto. Be safe, everyone, and join us tomorrow morning at 9 as we talk specifically about childcare. Thanks for listening to a recording of my live radio show on NPR News. A reminder, if you want to catch the show in real time, tune in and call in at a new time, 9 a.m. weekdays on NPR News.